This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Craig Shirley has written four bestsellers. He's known for his work on conservative giants like Ronald Reagan. His latest is called Citizen Newt. It's an authorized biography of Georgia's own 6th District Representative and former House Speaker, Newt Gingrich. And Craig Shirley joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
So let me ask the question that I assume is on the minds of everyone who read your book, which is, why does it end when Newt Gingrich becomes Speaker of the House?
Yeah, that's a good question, Celeste. I didn't intend it that way. It just kind of worked out. After 500 pages, I realized I hadn't even got into the 104th and 105th Congresses. I realized I was going to have to write a sequel. So, and I'm a romantic writer, like Introduction, Conflict, and Resolution to all my books. So I decided to end it there with the takeover, kind of on a high. And then once I get into Speaker Gingrich, which will be the sequel, I'll start with the beginnings of the 104th, and then later the 105th Congress, and then deal with Newt's resignation, of course, and then an epilogue, which brings everybody up to the present.
Okay, so then let's go back to the beginning, where your book really begins, and you spend quite a bit of time sort of putting us in context, historical context,
yes,
of when he first started running for Congress. He was a college professor here in Georgia. Why is it significant that his run for political office began during the era of Watergate?
Oh, it's very significant because we're looking at an old Democratic Party and a new Republican Party, something that hadn't been present in Georgia since Reconstruction. They're as rare as hen's teeth, Republicans were. Jack Flint was the incumbent Democrat, was a Jim Crow Democrat, was a segregationist, and as a matter of fact, refused to sit at the same table with Andrew Young, who was then a African-American, also a fellow Democratic congressman. But Jack Flint refused to sit at the same table with him over breakfast. Andrew Young, of course, later went on to become President Carter's ambassador to the United Nations. But so we're dealing with that. We're also dealing with the Republican Party, which is, in many ways, Gingrich is molding in his own image, which is progressive on race, conservative on economics and foreign policy, conservative on the Constitution, but also environmentally sensitive. It was kind of a strange amalgam of what he actually ran on in 74, 76, and 78.
A little bit ironic that one of the things he's known for is flipping the 6th District Republican at a time,
yes,
when that had been Democratic for a long time. And, of course,
forever.
Modern, in just last year, people were wondering if the 6th District would flip back the other way. What do you think made him successful in that, surprising most everyone?
He was campaigning in the modern era of the time. Jack Flint relied on a machine, a Georgia Democratic machine, to get him nominated, get him elected. Gingrich had to build his own political machine. He had to go out and stump aggressively and assertively and endlessly among the voters of Georgia. He'd go to, I look at his campaign schedule, and it was packed from breakfast right up till dinner, and everything in between were speeches, meet and greets, coffees, what have you. You know, it was the old-fashioned retail campaigning. Now, he did TV advertising, to be sure, but Atlanta was an expensive TV market for a challenger, not able to raise a lot of money. There wasn't a lot of dough for TV, so he had to rely more on the retail brand of campaigning. And it clearly showed, because even though he lost in 74, he got good reviews from the Atlanta Constitution, the Atlanta Journal, and the Atlanta Daily News, which was the African-American newspaper of record of the time.
Now, one of the reasons he was able to become Speaker of the House is because he was instrumental in bringing about the resignation of Jim Wright. And this is
correct.
Yes. And this is include. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Celeste. I beg your pardon.
I was just going to ask, at what point did he, yours is an authorized biography, so at what,
yes,
point did he sort of form that plan?
Boy, that's a good question. I think the fact of the matter is, I think he always had his sights set on corrupt members, and he proved it. You know, when he was first elected in 78, even before he's sworn into the House, he's already achieved somewhat of a national platform because national newspapers found him very interesting. They found him very compelling, this bright, engaging young college professor from Republican from below the Mason-Dixon line who wasn't supposed to win. So he'd already developed, the New York Times and the Washington Post and other publications took an interest to him even before he was elected. And he started going after a corrupt Democratic member from Detroit who was taking kickbacks from his own staff even before he's sworn in. And he manages to force his resignation by creating such a maelstrom and a focus of angst over this Democratic member. Then he goes after the chairman of the House Banking Committee, Freddie St. Germain, who was from Rhode Island, was using the House Banking Committee as his own personal fiefdom to pilfer the banks he was regulating, forced his resignation. He ended up going to jail. And then he sets his sights on Jim Wright. Now, Jim Wright is kind of known that he didn't always walk on the sunny side of the street, and that he had become speaker, but there was a lot of whispers and rumors about the nefarious deals. And what came to light was this really tawdry book deal in which he wrote a very poorly reviewed book, but it was bought up by the tens of thousands by special interest groups and labor groups. And this and Wright got an astonishing royalties off of each book. So it looked to everybody like it was just a money-making scheme. Gingrich, using his own investigative skills and also the staff and the leaks that were coming against Wright's enemies in Texas, led to more revelations about shady Cadillac deals, shady oil deals, shady cattle deals, everything. And Newt is leading a drumbeat, a solo one for a time, but then other forces join in. And then when finally reaches a crescendo, when the House Ethics Committee, which is dominated by Democrats, votes to investigate Jim Wright, and then he saw the handwriting on the wall and resigned. But this is his resignation speech from the well of the House. Was covered live by all three networks. This, you have to remember, the Speaker of the House is second in line for the President of the United States. And so this is big medicine in Washington when he forced Wright's resignation.
It ironic in a way, because he himself resigned
exactly.
In the light of ethics violations. But we don't get there yet.
So no, we don't get there yet. No.
In the time when leading up to where your book ends, leading to the sequel, when he takes Speaker of the House, you have a lot of praise for Newt Gingrich. But what mistakes did he make during the time that your book covers?
Oh, he made mistakes in terms of trusting certain people. He made mistakes in pushing issues too hard. He made mistakes, obviously, in his private life. His ethics investigation, which there were 130 ethics violations charged against him, although he was only found guilty on one count. The other 129 were dismissed, and it was making a fundraising appeal on congressional stationery to a group of to Henry Kissinger about meeting with some high-dollar contributors down in Georgia when Kissinger was going down there to give a speech. That was the only violation that they had him on. But by that time, he'd just taken too many barbs and too many slings and arrows that he finally saw the handwriting on the wall. But that's for the next book. He made mistakes in staff he chose. He made mistakes in issues he chose. He made mistakes in things that he said. But on the fundamental issues of corruption, of fairness, of conservatism, of progressivism, he was the first to fight for the Martin Luther King holiday, and the Reagan administration was very, very slow, reluctant to embrace that, and he forced them to embrace the Martin Luther King holiday. He also forced the issue. He noticed that in the U.S. Capitol, there wasn't one African-American statue or portrait, and he forced the issue to get Martin Luther King, his statue, added to the U.S. Capitol. So on the fundamental issues, he was mostly right.
That's author Craig Shirley. His new book is called Citizen Newt. It hits shelves in August. Craig, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Well, we just heard from Craig Shirley. Joining us now is a professor of history from Emory University that might help us put this more in perspective, Joe Crispino's specialty is 20th century political history with special emphasis on conservative politics. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So you heard me just talk to Craig about some of the mistakes Newt Gingrich made, but his book only goes up to his time when he took over Speaker of the House. What are some other things you'd point to? Things like pushing government shutdowns. What are the things were missteps?
Well, I think I would begin back where Mr. Shirley began, and We heard about the importance of his career beginning in Watergate, and that's true. He ran in 74 and 76 and lost. In 74, he lost because that was the kind of Watergate midterm where there's a lot of reaction against Republicans. But what's interesting about that time is the way that Republicans on the right, like Newt Gingrich, really used Watergate as a way to mobilize against establishment Republicans. And so one of the things that Newt Gingrich is most known for over his broad career is his career coincides with and helps accentuate this kind of hyper-partisanship that we see in our American political life today.
This sort of purity test.
Well, just kind of, you know, treating your opponents like mortal enemies, you know. And Gingrich did that not only with Democrats, but he also did it with moderate Republicans. I've got a great speech from that he gave in the 70s. I want to read just a snippet of it.
Quick.
Because it gives you just the sense of the kind of blood sport that Gingrich loved in politics. So this is a speech to the college Republicans in Atlanta in 1978. He said, "I think that one of the great problems we have in the Republican Party is that we don't encourage you to be nasty. We encourage you to be neat, obedient, and loyal, and faithful, and all those Boy Scout words, which would be great around the campfire, but are lousy in politics." That captures a lot of the kind of his love for political battle.
Let's actually hear from Newt himself. This is when he's talking about the contract with America, which is now legend.
"We've already told the incumbents and the candidates that if we have a majority, if the American people accept this contract, that they can expect to work 5 days a week in January, 6 days a week in February and March, and 24 hours a day around the clock towards the end if necessary."
What made the contract with America different and why and successful?
Well, it was part of a broad and a longer kind of buildup within the House of Representatives on the right, that kind of coalescing of a hardline Republicans who had been challenging kind of the mainstream of the party for several years. And so you see before, you talked about the Jim Wright episode, but there are other things that are going on. You know, Newt Gingrich is attacking Ronald Reagan in 87 and 88, trying to put a freeze on spending when the Reagan administration wants to lead to military buildups to help secure their position in negotiations with the Soviet Union. So he and Dick Armey and Tom DeLay, Trent Lott, these are kind of firebrands in the House who are moving the party to the right in the 1980s and 1990s. And then what happens is in 1992, you have a Democratic president elected, and they kind of coalesce around this campaign in the midterm elections of 94 and lay out this series of legislation that is really the culmination of a lot of their kind of conservative ideology that Gingrich had been pioneering over the course of the 1980s through organizations that he started, like the Conservative Opportunity Society, that are kind of, and that's, this is one of the great things about, or this is one of the, I'd say, his political strengths, is that he's able to kind of articulate conservative ideology in a very compelling way for his supporters. But that is always combined with Gingrich, with his love for political battle and mixing it up.
So, many of the things that Gingrich sort of instituted, the things that you're talking about, but also the sort of rough and tumble style of politics, are exactly what we see right now in the 2016 election, and that's been going on. So why has Newt Gingrich not been able to take advantage of that in his presidential campaigns, like in 2012?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think he did have, he did get some traction, but there was a lot of water that was beneath the bridge for...
You mean like sex scandals?
Well, a lot of scandals and the scandals when he was in the Speaker of the House. So I think he had kind of burned a lot of bridges over the course of that time. And it hurt himself a lot in those presidential games. You know, it's when you run for president, you know, when you have so much, you know, so many things that your opponents can target you for, it makes it a lot harder.
So what lasts still from the Newt Gingrich era when he was sort of the king of congressional politics?
Well, what lasts is that the House has in many ways become an ungovernable body. And Gingrich was the one who began this kind of scorched earth politics. I mean, this is, it's not Gingrich's fault, but Gingrich typifies broad trends in our politics that have heightened polarization. And you could talk about, I mean, we could spend the whole morning talking about these broad forces, technology, the rise of higher education. You know, political parties have become weaker. So one of the things that made the House of Representatives a functioning body is that you have party leaders who can discipline members and line them up and get the votes that they need. But over the course of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, because of changes in fundraising mechanisms and all a lot of different things, it becomes easier and easier for candidates to run without the support, without, you know, they can be critical of their party. They can run farther to the right and be critical of the mainstream of their party. And so what we see in the Republican Party is you know, people pushing further and further to the right. And whether it's Newt Gingrich, you know, or whatever leader is in place, you have members who are pushing further and further to right and undermining any kind of establishment governing politics that happens in the House of Representatives.
And brings a little bit of chaos.
It brings a lot of chaos, yeah.
That is Joe Crispino. He's professor of history at Emory University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have memories of Newt Gingrich, we'd love to hear them. You know how to get in touch with us. Coming up, the annual Afropunk Festival. First, though, we'll explain why a cop can start by giving you a speeding ticket and end by taking your car. This is on Second Thought.